Pepper podcast this week. Our guest is snowed in. Oh, that's a shame. I thought the weather was pretty mild. I guess this means to be the first podcast we've ever had without a guest. That's kind of weird. Oh, I misread that. Oh, okay. Oh, I see what I've done wrong. Okay. On the Empire podcast this week, our guest is the director of Snowden, Oliver Stone. Yes, he pops into the pod booth, plus all the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that, yes, tried that.
Really did make that joke.
It really went for it.
On purpose.
Really went for it. Hello, pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire podcast. This week, I'm joined by two colleagues of such lethal cunning who, like Edward Snowden, feel it's their duty to blow the whistle on immoral behaviour wherever they see it. First up is our geek queen, a lady who blew the whistle on the CW when it came to her attention they were planning an episode of Supernatural where Sam and Dean do not take their shirts off. Happily, she stepped in time. Disaster was averted. It's Helen O'Hara.
You still haven't seen an episode. Hello, Chris.
But I've seen episode synopses, so
none of which involve shirtlessness, because there is no shirtless.
They do now, because I went on Wikipedia last night, Helen, and I edited every single synopsis of every episode of Supernatural.
Hooray!
Was I wearing a shirt when I did it?
Oh, no.
I can't tell you, listeners, but yes. And next up is our resident Steven Spielberg expert, and I'm going to blow a whistle on him, because this is a man who I've been digging through his files, I've been doxing him, and turns out he thinks that Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, a fan-made film which came out a few years ago, is the best Indiana Jones film. That can't be true, can it, Ian Freer?
It is true, and to be honest, I've been hiding in the Bolivian embassy ever since. Oh no, that's Assange, isn't it? That's the wrong
Rightly,
that's right. The wrong whistleblower. I've got
Yeah, Russian embassy, Bolivian embassy, it's so difficult to keep them straight.
Which embassy is he in? It's the Ecuadorian, isn't it?
He's,
who knows? I mean,
yeah.
Who knows where he is?
Championships.
Yeah. He could be hiding in this room. We wouldn't know.
No.
We probably wouldn't would. Know. It's no. A very small room.
He could be hiding under the desk.
It's Benedict Cumberbatch, isn't it?
That's not true, Ian. You don't believe that Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is the best Indiana Jones movie?
I firmly believe that the Indiana Jones movies go in the order that they were made. From Raiders, in terms of quality, Raiders is the best. Kingdom of the Crystal Skull is the least best.
Yeah, he's so diplomatic.
Wow.
I have a lot of affection for Last Crusade. Different film. But you're probably not wrong. I will go with you on that.
I think that's a controversial one, Ian.
I think it's absolutely not controversial.
I think it is controversial. Because I think for years, everybody was like, it's Raiders and then Last Crusade and then Temple of Doom.
Yes.
There's been a switch. Yes. In the last 5-6 years.
Yes, when people now realise that Last Crusade is a Roger Moore, James Bond movie in disguise.
But a really fun one.
A very good one.
Yeah. Well, okay, I'm gonna let that pass for the time being. Last Crusade is a fantastic film and possibly my favourite of the four. And yeah, I said it.
You went
I said
there.
It. Oh yes, I am a woke bae.
Chris, that's not how you use that phrase.
No.
So we should probably...
Helen's been trying to teach me how to use
I've been trying
that
to,
phrase.
Yeah, it's really... Woke basically means like sort of socially, culturally, politically aware of your privilege.
Yes.
And
hello.
You know...
me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And angry about the systemic injustices in the world.
Is BAE, is that a hottie?
BAE is actually an acronym for before all else, or before all... Oh. Yeah, something like that. So so it's basically not just your favourite person. I think a lot of people assume it's a contraction somehow of the one-syllable word babe,
yeah.
But it is in fact an acronym for before all else. So it's the person you would put above all others.
So used together, that means...
It means Chris Evans. It means Mark Ruffalo. It means okay. People like that.
Hot Avengers, basically, is what you're saying.
But no, hot, politically aware, politically active, you know...
Avengers are politically aware.
I know they are. That was why. So I tweeted earlier this week, who is the wokest bae in the MCU? And like, it was a massive discussion because people have very strong feelings on who is most woke.
Oh, okay. Yeah, see, now this is beginning to make some sense to me. So you tweeted, you meant the actors, not the characters.
I meant the actors, yeah. Characters, okay. It's probably Vision or Cap.
I would say it's oh god, here we go again. But it's Cap. It's Cap. But because Chris Evans is quite Wookiee bae-y, isn't he? He's the Wookiest of the bays.
You're still using it wrong.
Yes, I'm a Wookiee bae.
You are a Wookiee bae. That is absolutely right.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you, Helen. for that insight. No, I know what that phrase means.
Of course you do.
I've used it many times on Twitter.
I'm still none the wiser, to be honest.
I'm now going back to delete all the tweets because I got it wrong. But that's interesting. Cool.
Yeah.
So thank you very much indeed for that. So we have a question. Here's a question. This week's question. It's from Twitter. It's from at AndyM1415. Catchy.
Made up name.
The son of the proud, Mr. and Mrs. M1415. And he asks, Andrew Moss is his name. How many times have Batman's parents actually been killed? And is there anyone else who has died as often?
Okay, let's take the first part of that question.
Okay.
Yep.
Can we thank the films of which we see the parents go?
Okay.
So
Batman v Superman : Dawn of Justice.
Yeah.
Yep.
Burton's Batman.
No,
yep. No,
he plays with it. Or at least the opening of the film plays with it, where he has another couple with a young kid outside
That's
a theater
right, he does.
Being menaced. Because it was already a cliche in 1989.
That's
just saying.
True. Okay. That's true.
So what are the films?
Batman Begins, where Batman's dad is played by Linus Roach. Means, of course, as we all know, that Ken Barlow from Coronation Street is Batman's granddad. Which is kind of amazing. And you keep expecting Batman to turn up on Coronation Street.
On the cobbles.
Yeah.
In the Rovers.
Chuck, get yourself a pint.
Is that how they speak?
I'm Batman. I must go down.
Okay.
The cabin.
But really, then, it's only two or three times we've seen Batman's parents die?
That's not too bad, is it?
That's all right, yeah.
Okay.
But it did give rise to one of the great cosplays, which is a couple who go around Comic-Con every year, dressed in just respectable clothing and a string of pearls, in the lady's case, not the man's. And every cosplayer they see dressed as Batman, they run up to him and shout, "Son," and then drop dead at his feet.
That's amazing.
Really?
Yeah.
That's inspired.
It's amazing.
That's kind of awesome. It's like the guy who dressed as Captain America at a recent Comic-Con. I'm not sure it was the Comic-Con, but it was at a Comic-Con. And he's dressed as Captain America and he just hung out inside a lift all day. And he would just wait for the lift to get full up. And then he would say, "Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?" And I don't think he actually started beating up people.
Yeah.
Are you sure? Because I don't know the other Batman movies that well. To my shame, I don't know Batman Returns that well. Yes, as I thought, Thomas Wayne and Martha Wayne are in Batman Forever. So presumably played by Michael Scranton and Eileen Seeley. So presumably they get killed in that as well.
Yes, okay. Because hang on, Batman Forever is the one where he's going to the psychiatrist, isn't
yes.
it?
Yes, Dr. Chase Meridian,
played by Dr. Nicole Kidman.
I don't know the Batman movies that well, but I know that character name. That will stay with me until I die. Dr. Chase Meridian, yeah. So Michael Scranton and Eileen Seeley. And of course, they're played most recently by Lauren Cohen and Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So. And what about the animated versions? Do the Batman's parents tell
Oh,
them
I there? Think they might actually, but I'm trying to remember which one.
Mm.
There was one I watched recently because I've been trying to go through them all. Oh, well done me.
All of them? Every single one?
Not all, like not every episode of every...
Like Mask of Phantasm and...
Yeah, all of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And Under the Red Hood, which of course, as you know, stars Dean Winchester. There's a lot of links actually between the Waynes and the Winchesters. You know, if Papa Wayne is also Papa Winchester then...
Oh my word.
Yeah.
Does he take his shirt off at any point?
Who, Papa Wayne?
Papa Winchester. Papa Wayne doesn't have a lot of time, in fairness. Although you wouldn't have put it past Zack Snyder for him to be oiled and sweaty.
It's cold in Gotham City. You're not taking your shirt off, are you?
No, I don't believe he's ever topless.
Okay. I think Linus Roach is the one who has the most impact because he's the one who's actually given lines and you get a sense of what he meant to Bruce Wayne as he was growing up. And, you know, he has that line, you know, mm-hmm. Why do we pick ourselves up? Why do we fall?
So we can pick ourselves up.
Yeah. That line that embedded itself in my memory. That one.
Yeah.
I think he's very good in that film.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
I like him.
Yeah. Did you know that he was the lawyer whenever Law and Order got cancelled? He was the sort of assistant DA, Mike Cutter, when it got cancelled, season 20.
I'll be honest,
one season shy of the record.
I don't watch Law and Order. Did you know that a lot of public defenders in the US hate it because it gives audiences the impression that prosecutors are always in the right? Apparently there's a genuine Law and Order effect that jurors who watch Law and Order are tougher on defendants.
Did you know that Demon Hunters hate Supernatural? Did you know that?
Yeah.
Because it gives the impression that all demon hunters are you know, gorgeous and take their shirts off a lot.
That's right.
Do you know that, Helen?
Yeah, I
do. So
did,
you
yeah.
tack my show, I'll tack your
all
show.
All right, you do that.
That's the way it works around
see,
here.
I haven't seen one episode of Law & Order.
What?
Not one.
And my, bang, bang.
My impression is it right that the first half of it is the law, so it's
yes.
cops,
yeah.
then the second half goes
is the order.
Into, is the legal,
it's also
legal.
The law, in fairness.
NYPD Blue for the first half and LA Law for yeah. the second half.
It should be that's called Law and Law.
Basically,
it should be that. It's a great show.
Right.
It's fine.
It's a very, very good show.
It's okay.
It's a great show.
Right.
You can attack me where I live. It's amazing. But yeah, it's very good. Sam Waterston's amazing as Jack McCoy, crusading lawyer stroke DA, and then it got cancelled. Anyway,
but back to the second part.
The second part of this question,
who has died the most?
Yes.
I am going to have a punt for Wile E. Coyote. he dies about four times every 3 minutes in those... I mean, death is a transient idea.
But
technically.
Also, how many seasons of South Park have we had now? Because Kenny has got to be up there.
That's a shout.
Yeah, Kenny's up there. Although, if I'm right in thinking that they stopped killing Kenny a long time ago. Certainly not every episode. Right. And the whole idea of South Park, if there's an episode where it's revealed that Kenny is actually immortal, and is some sort of living god, and has to go through this. Sort of Sisyphean torture of being killed every single week.
Full disclosure, I've never seen an episode of South. No,
I have.
I'm joking.
Wait a second.
But also...
okay.
We actually had this second part of the discussion quite recently.
Did we?
Yeah, Doctor Strange. Doctor Strange dies a thousand times in that spoiler. Oh, wait, that was a spoiler. Let me go back and
start. It's been out 5 weeks. I think we can...
Really? Okay. Anyway.
Everyone who listens to this podcast has seen that film.
All right, fine.
Yeah.
So Doctor Strange, a thousand or so times. And when we discussed that, of course, we discussed an episode of Doctor Who, where the good Doctor also dies a thousand times or so. And
it's the same in Supernatural.
Supernatural!
Yeah.
Booyah! They've been to heaven, hell, and purgatory, Dean has died at least a thousand times.
I know he died a lot, Helen.
Who's that?
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
He hasn't.
He died on stage every night, didn't he?
No.
No?
No, famously not.
That's not what I heard.
Oh!
You come on Law & Order, I'll come at you! That's how it works!
That's the Chicago way.
Bang, bang!
Well, today's going well.
Anyway, Bill Cage, Edge of Tomorrow, also dies a lot on screen. Phil Connors, Groundhog Day. You know, extrapolate that he dies by how many times? 1,000 times, 10,000 times? Who knows? But across different movies.
Right.
People dying across different movies. I mean, it's got to be kind of the obvious contenders, hasn't it? You know, films in which there's been a lot of remakes or films about Jesus.
Yeah, Jesus.
He dies a lot.
How many Sherlock Holmes movies have there been where Moriarty dies?
Hamlet. How many Hamlet movies have there been? How many Macbeth movies have there been? How many movies, you know? People have
Dracula.
Dracula. Yes.
Dracula.
Dracula has had to have died.
He's one of the most filmed characters, and, you know, he always dies at least once.
Yep, absolutely. Yeah. So it's got to be Dracula. And
Dracula, played by Sean Bean, has died so many times.
Oh, my God.
Especially if you consider Sean Bean's fan. It's like Kenny. Sean Bean's the same character. He's the same person in every single movie, every single TV show. He's just playing himself. Oh, bloody hell, been killed again. It's interesting. Dracula, definitely. Jason Voorhees, Freddy Krueger, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. That's a good question.
Helen's come up with it.
Yeah.
Dracula.
Helen rules.
Dracula.
And before people write in, that's a deliberate mispronunciation. People have actually been correcting me in my pronunciation of Dracula.
Yeah. Can you believe it?
I know.
It rhymes with Trianglia.
What is it? Yeah, it does. It does. I don't even know where I got Dracula from. I'm quoting something. Maybe Bottom. Maybe Rick Mayall in Bottom, who says suicide as suicide. Anyway. Thank you for your question.
I'll soon be reading your You Googly.
Can I say I prepped a question about body swaps
that
we were asked. And my body swap film is called Cockney Rebel. where Danny Dyer becomes Tom Hiddleston and Tom Hiddleston becomes Danny Dyer, and it's directed by Mike Lee and a posh director.
Oh my God, we could, yeah. You know, this isn't something, we could probably do this. We could probably facilitate this for like a feature in a mag, you know, like Wife Swap, but Life Swap, where we get Danny Dyer to be Loki. Thor, you muppet, you know. Yeah. That'd be amazing.
This is, and, I mean, after
Tom Hiddleston talking about severe eddies in very kind of...
Keiko Bako. Be amazing.
I'd see that.
Wow. To be honest, after the Who Do You Think You Are this week, I think he's never been more popular, Danny Dyer, so...
Yeah.
You know.
If people haven't seen that, check that out. It's so funny. Yeah. It's so warm. It's terrific.
I really want to see it. It's been recommended to me by everybody. Yeah. So.
Also, a 90-second version came around on Twitter.
I saw that.
Very, very funny.
There are 90-second versions of... for the American listeners who don't know who Danny Dyer is, he's something of a national treasure. He is he is an actor... he is a raconteur. He is a man of letters. Usually the first three, because he didn't get past that.
Come on, Chris.
He got the D. Of course, he got the D.
For a long time, he was kind of a despised actor.
Yeah.
He was in low budget gangster movies.
Dreadful, mm-hmm. dreadful shit.
Then he moved into a British soap called EastEnders.
Yeah.
And it's kind of turned him around a little bit.
Yeah. Spot on. Now, what he did is, a few years ago as well, he did like Danny Dyer's football gaffes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Videos where he'd be like, you know, be high lodge, he'd be geysering it up, going, look at this melon.
Yeah.
And then someone did a 60, 90 second compilation of Lowe's. It's really, really funny.
Yeah.
And he's a natural.
Yeah.
We love him.
He loves language. He's brilliant with language.
He's very inventive. Good old Danny Dyer. So that's how Danny Dyer is. That's an awesome idea. Right, if you want to have your question read out in the Empire Podcast and treat it with the respect it deserves, you can Tweeter us?
No.
Twitter?
Tweet.
You can tweet us like a woke bae to at Empire Magazine. Use the hashtag Empire Podcast. You can Facebook us as well. We're Empire Magazine and that. And you can email us podcast@empireonline.com. How exciting. Right, should we have some movie news?
Let's do it. Yes, I have much to say this week.
Okay, what's it what involving?
Well, I have floated on this podcast before the idea that some films should just be left alone.
Uh-huh.
You know, we don't go around remaking Casablanca. That's just a thing that everyone agrees is just a bad idea, and let's not. Okay. Uh-huh. Now, in that vein, someone's decided that what we really need is a new take on Little Shop of Horrors, one of the greats. I will hear no argument on this point, so don't even at me. there's apparently going to be a new one coming, a new adaptation of the musical by the great Alan Menken and the great late Howard Ashman as well. It was made into a movie in 1986 by Frank Oz with Rick Moranis, Steve Martin, Bill Murray was in there for... really no reason, but we were all glad to see it. and it's delightful and wonderful, and you should see it if you haven't already. And so now they're planning to do another one. Now, Greg Berlanti has not had the best luck on the big screen. He wrote Green Lantern and directed Life as We Know It, neither of which particularly set the world aflame. He's done much better on TV with The Flash and Arrow, which gets him a little bit of leeway here. But why? You know, I'm trying to. Anyway,
aren't these things good until you see them? You know what I mean? Why? He might have a take on it.
And to be honest, the way to do it, I guess, would be to try the ending that they rejected in 1986. So the stage play has a much more downbeat ending.
Mm.
Let me just say that the cast all reprise the song "Somewhere That's Green." And it means something different this time. But the audiences apparently find that too depressing in 1986, so they kind of left it out. So you could have a whole new take that involves that. But I just know that's my...
Oh, that's amazing. Oh, we should have something like that every week. This new story just ends with you going, no, don't fancy that.
But bish, yeah, bash, just bush. You know, I'm really struggling to think who could be a better Audrey than Ellen Green. She looks the part. She's tiny and sort of frail looking, and then she opens her mouth and belts out these huge numbers like nothing you've ever heard. Like, to the extent where she actually performed on stage a couple of years ago with Jake Gyllenhaal, and they did Suddenly Seymour, which is one of my karaoke classics. And she does it much better.
Okay.
Yeah, so she was singing Suddenly Seymour with Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah.
And basically blew him off stage. I mean, and he's quite a good singer, actually. And when she's actually sort of like let loose, it was honestly like someone had just, you know, opened one of the, you know, those doors in adverts, and you open it and there's this huge blast of air and people are flung backwards.
Yeah.
That it was that, basically.
So, wow.
Yeah. Anyway, so I am of course open-minded and looking forward to this new interpretation, but I'm super skeptical. So I'm really hoping that they do it justice, because it's great.
Yeah, I think Anna Kendrick could do well.
I don't know if her voice is big enough. She's got a gorgeous voice. I don't know if she's got that capacity for oomph that you need.
I think she can oomph.
Oh, you say. So that is a thing that is happening.
That is a thing that is happening.
Hey, speaking of things that are happening.
Okay.
Transformers, The Last Knight. Can someone explain the trailer to me?
Well, let's talk about all the trailers that came out this week, with the exception of Spider-Man Homecoming, because that's going to be up just as this podcast goes live.
Mm-hmm.
We know that's happening, so sorry about that. But we have seen, 15 seconds of the trailer for Spider-Man Homecoming. Looks very Spider-Man-y.
Sure.
Little concerned about how the lengths are going to make it hip and cool, with Peter Parker being like, you know, taking selfies and talking to the camera and, you know, his camera phone, presumably. But, you know, we'll see. You know, he's young. He's hip. He's with it.
Andrew Garfield has been promoting silence over the past few weeks. Has been saying how disappointed he was.
Yeah.
With his two takes on it.
Yeah.
How they left the character behind and...
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, because it genuinely means a lot to him, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Which is a real shame. A real shame. I thought he was a fine Peter Parker. You know, he was just let down by the movies, I think, that around him that just weren't up to scratch.
Mm.
But hopefully this one will be good. We like the Tom Holland Spider-Man that we saw briefly in Civil War.
Yeah. We did.
I mean, it's amazing that they got a historian to play a 19-year-old.
No, it's the director.
It always surprised me. His dad is Dominic Holland, isn't he?
Yes.
It was always, if you don't know him, he's on the kind of a stalwart of breakfast TV in the mornings. He's a kind of pundit kind of person.
Yeah, he's a stand-up.
Yeah.
I met him very briefly on the set of The Impossible.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a interesting guy. Dominic Holland. So, you know, fingers crossed for this one. Happy Hogan, we know, is in the trailer. So I wonder if this trailer, you'll know, obviously, listeners, because you'll have seen it by the time you're listening to this. But I wonder if they're going to hint at any other MCU people. We know that Robert Downey Jr. is in the film with Tony Stark. I wonder if we're going to see Tony Stark. I don't know how big a part Stark's going to play in this movie, but it's going to be intriguing to find out.
Mm.
But anyway, that's 15 seconds of that trailer. But we had... three big trailers out over the week. So we had The Mummy, Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
In The Mummy. We had Transformers The Last Knight. And we had Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2. Anything else? Am I missing anything? Or is that was a big three, right?
Those are the big ones.
Those are the big ones.
Yeah.
Okay. Those are the Christopher big ones. And all right. So let's talk about the first one that you mentioned.
Yeah.
Transformers.
I don't understand anything anymore. I'm so confused. I mean, I get that there's time travel.
Yeah.
I think.
There's King Arthur,
mm-hmm.
of course, and Hitler, and Transformers, and Optimus Prime is under mind control, or has a clone, an evil clone?
An evil, is that what you're guessing?
I don't know.
All right,
anymore.
So the trailer for this is just a succession of very pretty images.
Yes.
Yeah.
I'd say one thing. Bay can shoot the hell out of stuff.
He's a shooter.
Yeah, he really is.
My God.
Terrific.
And so Earth appears to be in the grip of a war with the Transformers.
Yes.
And Optimus Prime has left the planet, which he did at the end of the last movie.
But he's like floating dead in space.
Because he's floating in space.
Or somebody else is floating dead in space. Because it was suggested to me by a Transformers superfan, hi Sanam, that Optimus Prime has an evil clone. Yep, that's right.
Ploptimus Prime.
Right. Yes. So, that could be a thing that's happening.
And how does Mark Wahlberg fit into all this?
I don't know, but if you saw that sort of ED-209 figure there at one point in the trailer, maybe like he's helping make, because he was a bit of a tinker, a bit of an inventor, maybe he's helping make things to fight the baddie Transformers?
The Decepticons. Yes.
We are so up on this.
But I know it's interesting because it's a teaser trailer, but it's a 2.5 minute teaser trailer. And none of the teaser trailers this week, I mean, they're all teasers. Guardians was a teaser. The Mummy was a teaser. We got no sense of the overall plot of the film, really.
True.
But I got no sense that there is a plot in Transformers The Last Night. It looks fantastic. It looks brilliant. Mm. There's a bit where Optimus Prime, because he is in the trailer, they go, Optimus Prime has left us. He's floating in space, presumably because he's looking for Cybertron or a USB port or something. And then he obviously comes back.
Yeah.
And then something happens in the film, whether he's under mind control or whether it's an evil clone or whether, like me, he's just sick of Bumblebee's shit after five movies. He decides to try and stab Bumblebee in the face.
Yeah.
And I am all for that.
You are a monster, sir. A monster.
I'm all for it. Bumblebee, you're rubbish, mate.
I'll go and see it and find out, but I just don't know what's happening, and I've never felt so unmoored. You know.
Don't worry, we've got plenty of time.
Oh,
we'll find out.
Look, Akiva Goldsman has written the story for this. We're in safe hands. He's got it. It's fine. It's all good. But also, there's the prospect of Tony Hopkins playing what seems to be playing Winston Churchill. Now, we know that Churchill's in this film, and Tony Hopkins' voiceover is throughout the trailer, and it sounds like he's half bothering to do a Churchill voice and then half, don't really fancy it, to be honest. And and there's a shot of him at one point looking like he could be Churchill, but again, like he only got halfway through the makeup and then went, no, I'm done now. And then that's it. So that could be intriguing.
I mean, yeah, listen, it's definitely intriguing in the sense that there's all of this crazy stuff happening and I want to understand more. So, I guess job done, trailer.
Let me remind you that Empire, every day is Christmas Eve.
Exactly.
I know, right? What about Christmas Day, though? Are we not allowed Christmas Day?
That's our tragedy. We never get the Christmas Day. So there's Transformers Last Night. And then we have the trailer for the Mummy. So this is the reboot of The Mummy.
Yes.
The Universal Studios version of this, because obviously there's been lots of mummies throughout the years. Obviously they made the Boris Karloff version back in 1932, mm-hmm. I want to say. Then 1999, obviously Stephen Sommers with Brendan Fraser, which was a kind of Indiana Jones pastiche.
Not necessarily a horror film.
I like the first film. And then other films exist in that franchise.
I don't think that they do, but the first one is great. It's lovely.
There's a great gag, though. Is it the first one or the second one? Where John Hannah comes out of a temple and sees lots of possessed people going, Imhotep,
and he just goes in with them.
And he goes in with them and starts going, ooh, Imhotep, and blends in, disappears.
Seamlessly.
Then he's got the grail already. Is that first or second?
That's the first one.
Is that the first one?
The first one has all the good bits. It has the cinema's best librarian. It has, she's kind of terrible with the whole knocking over the bookcases, but other than that, she's fantastic.
She's not as good as librarian in Last Crusade.
Oh, he's right.
Librarian. Oh, he's pretty good too.
He's right. Yeah. He's got it. Nailed
okay,
it.
Okay, two good librarians.
Cinema's best librarians.
And you've changed your tune in Last Crusade pretty quickly.
Well, no, the bar's high. It's a very hard bar.
If you're a Scottish lot, then I am Mickey Mouse! Not a librarian.
What I find interesting about this new film is that it's set in the modern world as opposed to some kind of Indiana Jones pastiche. So I think that's kind of interesting. Asian cars versus iPhones versus, that's
absolutely
an interesting dynamic, isn't it?
So the only thing that really confused me in this, like I got that Tom Cruise is in a plane crash because it's a Wednesday, so obviously he's in a plane crash,
Do you not get on a plane with Tom Cruise?
Never get on a plane with Tom Cruise. But I was confused by the whole resurrection thing. That seemed...
All right, so I went to LA last week, which is why I wasn't on the pod last week, and I spoke to Alex Kurtzman for a trailer breakdown, which you can now read on the website. And obviously I got a whole lot of, I can't tell you that, without revealing too much, but the implication is that at some point in the movie, whether it's in the plane crash or in the aftermath of the plane crash or just before it or at some point. Anyway, Tom Cruise is cursed by the mummy.
Oh.
And he and the mummy become inextricably linked in some way. And therefore, that allows him to stay alive. And also, it allows your protagonist to go toe-to-toe with your antagonist who has a bunch of scary powers and still live.
I see.
So that's interesting. There's a number of things about this movie that certainly intrigue me. One, modern day, although as Alex Kurtzman pointed out to me, the Boris Karloff movie was set in modern day for
the time.
That intrigues me. You're absolutely right about that. The idea that Cruise, this is interesting, because this is meant to be the first part of Universal's new Monsters shared universe.
Yes.
The Universal Monsters. The MCU, if you will.
That's not confusing.
MSU, Monsters Shared Universe. Shared Monsters Universe, SMU.
Universal Monsters Shared Cinematic Universe. The UMSCU.
The UMSCU. All right, the UMSCU.
Okay,
there
so it's the first in the UMSCU. And I just had this idea. I tweeted the other day, going, "Wouldn't it be cool if Tom Cruise was in all the movies? He's the thing that links them together, right? Tom Cruise is the thing that links them together. You know, it's Tom Cruise versus Dracula. It's Tom Cruise versus Frankenstein's monster.
So he's the Abbott and Costello of this franchise.
He's the Abbott and Costello's franchise. And then someone else tweeted me, and I'm sorry, I forgot your name. Someone tweeted me, going, "What if he's Van Helsing?" Now, as I started thinking, hang on a second. You might be onto something here, because if you remember, cast your mind back, a couple of years ago, Tom Cruise was attached to a reboot of Van Helsing at Universal to be written and directed by Alex Kurtzman. That project seems to have disappeared, gone off the radar. Or has it?
Wow.
Is the big reveal of this movie that Tom Cruise is somehow a reincarnation of, or maybe actual Van Helsing, and that he will go on to fight all the scary monsters.
Isn't it weird? I find it weird sometimes how big the name Van Helsing has become.
Well,
I know he's in Dracula and everything, but he's not like the protagonist of, not like that, Chris.
Oh, okay.
He's not like, you know, really the hero.
He's cool. He's very cool.
He's old and he wears tweed.
He comes in, he takes no shit, he knows what's going down.
Yeah, that's true.
He's pretty cool. He's much better.
He
than
looks
that.
Like Hugh Jackman. I mean, I guess yeah. When
or
you,
Tony
when you
Hopkins,
put it like that.
Or Peter Cushing.
That's really confusing.
I think it's more the fact that, you know, he's been played by amazing people over the years, and he has become indelibly linked with vampire hunters, and you know, the notion of fighting monsters, and he's, you know, he looks like Peter Cushing. That's what I think of when I think of Van Helsing. But it's that's a theory.
Yeah.
Mm.
By no means fact.
Yeah,
but it could be interesting.
It's gonna be like Westworld, where all the theories turn out to be true. And
it might be Alex Kurtzman, who obviously listens to this podcast, is probably going, "Oh, Twitter, you've beat me to it." It could be interesting because we know that Russell Crowe in this movie, we see him in the trailer, and he's playing Dr. Henry Jekyll.
Yeah.
And we will see him as Edward Hyde at some point. So this is the whole idea that they're going to do a League of Extraordinary Gentlemen type thing. They're going to bring in a lot of characters who, you know, have no copyright, I guess, anymore, or in the public domain.
But not to trump Chris, but I also talked to Alex Kurtzman.
No!
And he was saying he didn't have a movie until he made The Mummy female. He couldn't find a way to make it fresh.
Okay.
And the best thing in that trailer,
she's great.
Sophia Patel's eyes going into four, her pupils go, it's terrific.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, she looks really cool, actually. Yeah. So fingers crossed for that.
I think she's going to be very, very good. You know, the movie itself, we'll wait and see, but I'm intrigued. And if that does turn out to be the case, that it is Cruise in whatever form fighting the monsters, because you think about this, they can't really just have a monster movie and then a Dracula movie and then a mummy movie and then a Dracula movie and then a Frankenstein movie, a Wolfman movie, and then expect these evil things to come together to fight a force greater than them. I mean, it has to be, would you think, someone
picking them off one by one,
a hero fighting them rather than you know.
Yeah, it doesn't make much sense that they'd get together, really, does it? Because, like, you know, anywhere the mummy felt comfortable, Dracula would be well out of place. Like, it just wouldn't really fit.
Yeah.
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 And if anyone's been following Nick Desemlian's Twitter feed this week, he's charting the name changes in Tom Cruise's character, which started as Tyler Colt and move to Nick Morton.
Yeah.
So it could well go to Van Helsing, couldn't it?
Why not?
Well,
yeah. Why not? Nick Morton, Abraham Van Helsing, it's just a small step. And then the trailer that really, I loved this week that I just thought was amazing, made me laugh a lot, and I've seen it quite a lot, is the Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2 trailer. I know it's preaching to the choir with me, but I thought this was absolutely fantastic.
I thought it was fun. I could have done with, you know, Gamora getting a line.
I knew you'd say that.
Well, seriously.
I knew you'd say that. I said to my... Oh, God, here we go, drinking game. I said to my wife, someone's going to say something about Gamora not having a line in this trailer. Someone's going to say it. And I hadn't seen it. And now you've done it. You know why? Because you're a woke bae.
Thank you. That's really kind of you to say. But no, genuinely, like, she's a character too. Everybody else gets their little character moment.
She does cool stuff.
Does she?
Is there some cool running stuff?
She gets some cool stuff.
Not really.
But, you know, that aside, it's a really, really funny trailer.
Yes.
And it just makes you realise that these characters are enormous fun to be with.
Yes, they are.
And I cannot wait to see them again. That
kind of post-credits thing where the three of them are talking about secret feelings, and that's very fun.
Yeah, a lot of fun. And just, you know, the idea that, you know, Rocket and Groot, Baby Groot, who's the cutest thing.
Baby Groot is super cute.
Cutest thing around. Yeah. Why would Rocket entrust such a clearly dangerous and important task to an idiot tree?
Maybe he's not an idiot. You're just sizist, Chris.
I am. I have a question.
Okay.
Maybe you can answer this. So, at the end of Guardians of the Galaxy, not to give too much away, but Groot is...
Oh, you just spoiled a film 5 weeks old.
You did, in fairness.
But you told me to.
Oh, yeah. If I told you to stick your head in the fire, would you do that as well?
No.
Okay. So Guardians of the Galaxy, at the end of it, Groot is scattered into his component parts, okay?
Yes.
So Rocket picks up part of Groot. He wants to keep part of Groot. And then that awakens at the end of the movie and will grow into the baby Groot that we see in the film. Mm. Does that happen with every part of Groot that's scattered on Nova Prime?
Well, we are Groot, isn't it?
But was it just luck that he picked the one branch that grows into baby Groot?
No, I'm pretty sure that Groot's a sort of a... You know, it's like one of those giant funguses that grows underground.
Mm-hmm.
That, like, all of it is part of the whole. It's a synecdoche of itself, if you will.
Yes, that explains it. I think I got it. But you're right, I noticed the Gamora thing as well. She gets to run up and jump and stab at some stuff, and she gets to look demure as that funny line plays out with Star-Lord. But, yeah, it's a shame.
What were the big new elements? What were the things that you hadn't seen before?
There are no new elements, and that's the interesting thing, that they're basically, with this trailer, they're going, these guys are back. And
remember these guys? Yeah. You love these guys.
They're such fun. Look at them, and they're having more fun, and you want to be with them, and we're holding back all the other new stuff. Again, no sense of story, no sense of what the hell is going on. No Kurt Russell. There is one new character, Mantis, in fairness. We do see Mantis at the end of the trailer. She's the one who goes, I can tell what you're feeling. But otherwise, it's still a lot to be revealed. And hopefully we'll get to hear Gamora speak next time.
Well, we live in hope. Maybe she has a line somewhere.
I suspect she'll have a line. Maybe even two.
Women.
Or maybe she'll be a pivotal part of the movie, Helen. It's Christmas Eve. Right. What else?
Well, there was news about the Oscars.
Okay.
Which is that Jimmy Kimmel will be hosting in 2017, which sort of seems like, okay, yeah. Makes sense, I guess. He's a late night TV host. There is a history of hiring late night TV hosts to do the Oscars. He hasn't recently disgraced himself by ruffling Trump's hair. And he has a long standing tradition of doing a big show around the Oscars where he gets everybody in and does a big thing with them. So it's sort of fit. If you haven't seen, by the way, The Handsome Men's Club, which he did a few years ago, I highly recommend watching it.
Yes. And all the stuff he does with
Montana. I don't know that much about him other than, is he spiky? Is he?
He's kind of between
Fallon and, he's not as playful as Fallon, but he's not as spiky as Letterman. He's somewhere in between.
That's probably fair, I guess.
He's smarter than Fallon, but then again, this cup of water is smarter than Fallon. I think it's a really good choice. I think he can be very, very funny. He can play around with Hollywood. He has enough relationships within Hollywood to be able to playfully play with people, but also I think he could be quite snarky when he wants to be.
Yeah.
I think this is a good choice. It's a good choice. Yeah. I think it'll be fine. What's interesting as well is that they're throwing this thing together really, really quickly.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories in the trades about how late they are in getting this together.
Yeah, they only just hired the producers, a month ago. And now the host. And we'll see how it goes.
Maybe that's a good thing. Maybe you need a bit more spontaneity because sometimes it feels so overcooked and it really doesn't work. So, fingers crossed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Right, should we move on to this week's guest?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. He was snowed in, but he dug himself out again. No? No?
Sure.
No? Go with that?
Yeah.
Carry on? No.
You've broken us down, Chris. Just go with it.
Time now for this week's guest. He is a directorial legend, one who never shies away from tackling political hot potatoes and asking the big questions. Questions like, who killed JFK? What was the point of the Vietnam War? And will anyone notice if Alexander the Great has an Irish accent? Yes, it's Oliver Stone. He's back this week with Snowden, the story of notorious whistleblower Edward Snowden, who's played in this movie by Joseph Gordon-Levitt. We sent our very own crusading investigative type, Nick Desimlin, along to talk to Oliver Stone. Enjoy.
So we're very, very happy to welcome Oliver Stone to the Empire podcast this week to talk about Snowden. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
I have a Rubik's Cube question for you, first of all.
Yeah.
Because it struck me watching the film that if there was merchandise for Snowden, you could do a very nice Edward Snowden Rubik's Cube.
Right. I'm sure the Rubik's Cube's people had a little extra business around the world. But this was a dramatic device we used because the truth has to be concealed. It's really, he's under indictment. And he just doesn't want to give that kind of information away. But he suggested this is a parallel activity that would work for the purposes of what he did.
There's a really nice introductory shot of him. The first you see of Snowden is a close-up of his hand on the Rubik's Cube. Was that your idea to introduce him like that?
Well, we thought of it, sure. It was in the script, sure. Why not do it there?
This movie, at first glance, and indeed while watching it, seems very much in your wheelhouse, the type of kind of thing you're interested in.
Yeah.
Was it a no-brainer for you to
Not
to
at all.
It?
No, this was a very difficult movie to get made. It took 2.5 years. The concept alone, first of all, getting involved in it took a long. I had to talk to Ed, and repeatedly, I went 3 times to Moscow to understand, and I suppose we had to trust each other and warm up to each other to the degree that he would reveal to us it is his story, so it is, and it is told from his point of view, and it's a subjective movie. Of course, we checked as much as we could, but the NSA is not talking about it in any official capacity. It makes sense what he says. It makes sense. And he describes very methodically everywhere he worked and how he attained information and participated in the programs. And, of course, he's in a sliver of the programs. This is a gigantic agency with 30,000 people and a tremendous budget, by the way. So it's even bigger than this. But what we see in his story is not only data mining on a global scale, massive, without democratic consent, but we also see drone warfare and cyber warfare and the origins of that, because cyber warfare comes from that space. And it's a very dangerous thing we've started. In 2007 in Iran, we started using it.
And is it true that during the making of this, you kind of concealed the project from the NSA a little bit?
Well, we certainly didn't have our script online. We kept it offline, and we did everything possible to secure the script. We never had it in one piece. We sent sections to people. And when necessary, we would go with codes and encryption as much as possible.
Did you have a code name for the film?
Yes, we did.
Can you reveal that at this stage?
I've never thought of that, revealing it. It was called Sasha.
There we go. That's a big exclusive for us. Thank you. Are you very kind of wary about what information you put online?
Well, we stayed offline, but I was always fearful that the script would be hacked first, because for a hacker, that's a bounty. I mean, Snowden is known as probably the greatest hacker in the world at that point. So to get a script of his, in which he's involved, would be a coup and a bounty. And then I was worried about the film getting hacked and appearing 2 months before the film came out. Our film came out. That would have been devastating, but it was also possible in this new world.
And just going back to, in terms of watching your oeuvre again to prepare for the book, was there another film that you... that you looked at and thought, oh, I would have done that differently if I had another chance?
Well, I did have another chance on Alexander. I took the chance myself and I built it into the DVD because the resolution is so good. You know, I'd love it to see it on a big screen, but I think we have to settle for
a big screen
at home, which is far better than it used to be. Other films I would have done differently, not enough to recall to say I would start over. No, I've always felt like I was doing it the best I could at the time.
And I caught Natural Born Killers on Netflix recently, yeah. And I think that really holds up. It still
great.
Packs a real punch.
That gives me a great energy. If he makes me feel good, let's talk.
Thank you.
I appreciate your saying that because I really loved that movie. And I always worry that when it's shown on TV or recycled that they'll miss the colors. They won't get the right texture because it's so much, there's so many, we play with the texture of that film so much. You know, that sometimes I saw a bad screening of it once and it just destroyed the movie for me because it just didn't have the right light. But so I'm glad you feel that way.
Is there one of your films that you think has been unfairly maligned or underappreciated?
U-Turn. Heaven and Earth, Nixon, none of those made money. They were beautiful films to me. Alexander did very well, actually, internationally, so I'm not going to put that in that category, although it is a completely different cut. But those three, Nixon, U-Turn, and Heaven and Earth, abominable business, but they were not sold right, but doesn't matter. Heaven and Earth is a beautiful film. It makes you, to me, still makes me cry, and it's an authentic story about a young girl who came from a poor village, and she had an enormously complex life, and she ended up in America, and she goes back and forth now between two worlds. U-Turn is, a lot of people still love it. It's just a black, black film. I mean, it's very, very dark, but it's funny, and great cast.
I'm a big fan of U-Turn as well.
Oh, you've seen it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Wonderful. It's a Soleil Noir, I call it, Black Sun kind of movie.
Nice.
Nixon, the English, I particularly liked it. It's a my most mature film in terms of its white men talking with haircuts. It looks like a British play, strange haircuts. But it's very, very true to Anthony Hopkins did a great job on that and a powerful film.
I mean, Donald Trump pops up in Snowden. Donald Trump kind of makes a very quick appearance on a TV screen. And I was just wondering, I'm sure you get asked this a lot, but what are your thoughts watching all this Trump stuff unfolding? And do you think do you think of it in terms of a film? Or what kind of film you would make out of it?
You Europeans are fascinated by Donald Trump. He's certainly captured the imagination of the world, which shows that he's a great reality TV performer, which I've always felt he's bigger than life. He's a great salesman. I've met him. He was in Wall Street. He was in a scene. It was a deleted scene, not because of him, but because it was just overstuffing at that point, Wall Street number two. I think he's not my choice for public office. He's too erratic for that, but his life would make a good movie one day, but I'm not sure I'm the right person to make it. I don't make president movies. I make movies about situations that fascinate me. The Bush movie, W, was really, because it was also, to me, like Snowden movie, a crucial, crucial time in American psyche when we turned over the country to a guy who was not qualified to be president. And disastrous consequences at the beginning of the century with the Iraq War and the War on Terror. But Nixon also was fascinating me because of his power and his flaws and his insecurity. At the same time, his potential greatness. He could have been a better president.
And there's kind of a lost Oliver Stone film in a way, because you were going to make a Martin Luther King film.
I was, and I had a beautiful... for a long time, I was. I actually wrote... Anyway, it doesn't matter. I wrote about 1965 to 68 period, the last 3 years of his life, when the struggle for him moved beyond civil rights, which was crucial, but that was his base. But it became a struggle against a system of power that was dictating the Vietnam War at that time. It was a concept of militarism, a concept of racism, and a concept of poverty. He was really attacking the American way of business as well as, and that was a big issue. It got him into a hell of a lot of hot water. And I think it brought him closer and closer to God, which is very important. I think it's a very spiritual movie. You'll see it if one day, and maybe.
Is that still on the back burner?
Not on my back burner. I don't own it, but I'd love to see something like that made.
And what else are you kind of working on? There's a documentary in the works, I believe.
Yeah, there's a documentary on Putin. I've met him and filmed about 15 hours, and now I'm going to go back to some more. He's a very interesting and pivotal figure that the Americans have insanely focused on as an enemy.
As somebody who's met him, is he that person that gets
painted
in? Well,
I think that's the surprise of the movie. I think he's a quite... You know, he's quite accessible and personable in his own way. And I think you have to understand that he is who he is. And he's, as far as he's concerned, he's representing Russian interests, as I would if I was a leader of any country. You represent those interests. And you have to understand that the United States' interests are not to encourage a strong Russia, are not to encourage an independent Russia. So this is contrary to what the Russian concept of their own identity is.
Yeah, interesting. And is there a feature film as well, beyond the Putin documentary?
I can't say. I mean, I've written a couple of things. You know, I'm pushing 70 now, getting older, and I'd like to... you know, you only want to make a film if it really makes sense to make it, if there's a reason strong enough to do it. Because it's so difficult, and the Snowden film kicked the shit out of me. I'm a little bit deflated from that, but
yeah,
you know, going back in there again, you have to do it from love.
Okay, all right, Oliver Stone, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
So that was Oliver Stone, and that's kick off this week's review section with Snowden.
Yeah, so this stars Joseph Gordon-Levitt as the computer whiz himself, very much sort of timely look at what he did and his impact. And it sort of follows his life a little bit further back than you might be aware of. So it starts off when he wants to be a soldier. He's very much a sort of George W. Bush patriot. And then he gets injured, and that kills his dreams of serving in the military. So instead, he uses his computer skills to become a government intelligence agent. He falls in love with a spirited photographer, played by Shailene Woodley. And all seems to be well in Edward Snowden's life until he realises just how far his employer, the NSA's snooping goes, and comes to believe that he has to do something about this. He has to kind of get the truth out there. So we actually open the film with the famous meeting in Hong Kong, 3 years ago, between him and Zachary Quinto's Glenn Greenwald, mm-hmm. and Melissa Leo's Laura Poitras. And they're basically meeting him to sort of try and verify what the heck it is he's offering them, what the heck it is that he's claiming, and begin what became the process of his revelations. So it's that's the setup, and then we flash back to 2004, and then we have, you know, we go back through his life from there. I think what Oliver Stone does is try and put his personal life a little bit more front and centre than we have been aware of, I think, as an audience before.
I guess that's what Laura Poitras' film doesn't do, does it?
Exactly,
that's
yeah.
about the...
The revelations, yeah. and not about him as a, yeah. as a human being, yeah. So I think the Shailene Woodley is very good, and she kind of helps make him a human a little bit more than I think we have before. Mm-hmm. So it's almost a kind of a love story section there in the middle, but then of course global politics intervene and kind of get in the way of that, I guess. Sometimes it's a little bit on the nose, as you kind of expect from an Oliver Stone film, don't you?
Yeah, that's par for the course, isn't it?
Yeah, but a really, really good cast. Reese Evans is in there as well.
Nick Cage.
Yeah, very briefly. Yeah. Weirdly, Snowden himself has a appearance which is confusing slightly when you've just been watching Joseph Gordon-Levitt, but that's fine. I mean, he was heavily involved in the production and consulted heavily, so I guess sort of makes sense in a weird way. But yeah, this was fine, but not kind of one of Stone's best. I think it's fair to say we gave it 3 stars.
3 stars. What did we really give it, Helen? If we
dug
a little deeper,
yeah. I'll be blowing the whistle on
three.
That later.
Oh, yeah. It says 3.
Yeah. Does he actually blow a whistle at any point in the film? It's a real...
What, like a demented football referee?
Yeah.
You know, that would
Stop
have been...
Stop that, NSA!
That would have been brilliant if instead of like sneaking things out in a Rubik's Cube, he'd sneaks his secrets out in a whistle. That would have been amazing.
Yeah.
That Rubik's Cube thing's cool, though.
It is cool, yeah. That's really good.
Do you know what I discovered the other week? I have a North Face rucksack.
Okay.
And on the straps, you can actually clip the straps together and it forms on it. It's a whistle. There's a whistle on your straps. So if you're up a mountain and you get lost, you can blow the whistle. However, it's a rubbish whistle. So it literally goes... Awful.
Did you know that they make rucksacks now with an avalanche survival kit in them? So if an avalanche hits, these giant sort of balloons explode on either side of your backpack and apparently improve your chances of survival by 95%.
I need that for the tube.
Yeah, everybody needs that for the tube.
Can you imagine?
That sounds like something Sheldon Cooper would have in the Big Bang Theory, isn't it?
Amazing. Where were we? Oh, yes, three stars.
Three stars,
yes. Or is it?
Is a recommendation.
For Snowden, or was it? And next up we have Office Christmas Party. No conspiracy here. This is a big pile of Christmas poo.
That's who wants a bit to take much, shouldn't it?
Two stars.
Yeah, it's like stars, though.
So, Jennifer Aniston is the CEO of Zenitech, and she's shutting down the local branch. So to save it, her brother, played by TJ Miller, gangs up with Jason Bateman to throw a massive party to impress a client who could save all their jobs.
Oh.
I think that's the gist of it.
That is the gist. You are correct, yeah.
And it's a bit like having your sort of nose pressed up against a party. You know, everyone's having tons of fun except you. Really. It's a bit like that. But props to Kate McKinnon, who kind of as a kind of a HR person is very, very funny. She's kind of the diamond in the poo.
It's a bit of a shame, isn't it? Because it's such a great cast.
It's a really good cast.
Yeah.
As you get with many comedies, it's a bit of a third act.
You think there's a car chase thrown in, there's all sorts thrown in, but you think that Office Christmas parties are ripe for the dreadfulness of them and the awfulness and the last episode of The Office is a Christmas party, isn't it? That's how you do it.
The embarrassment of Christmas party. This was just a bit raucous, and I don't know. It's just kind of interesting. It feels to me like one of those American comedies that is just largely improvised, and they just went, "Oh, we got really funny people. We got TJ Miller. TJ Miller can improvise anything. Yeah. Just Kate McKinnon. Yes, just go for it." Yeah. Whereas I saw
Olivia Munn turns up. She's the office crush, and
I saw, what did I see the other day? I saw Pop Star Never Stopping, which I managed to miss when it came out at the cinema. And that's a really funny film. But more importantly, it feels like a film that, has a little bit of improv in it, no doubt. But it feels really tightly scripted at the same time. There are actual jokes that The Lonely Island sat down and wrote. Mm. And it feels to me, I've said this in the podcast before, I'm banging the same drum. But it just feels to me like there's a dearth of that in certainly American comedy at the moment.
We'll be talking about another one soon. Spoiler.
Will we?
Yep.
Which one?
Another American comedy that may or may not suffer the same problem. Spoiler.
Okay. Which one?
I can't say. I'm embargoed.
Oh, I know
Monday.
What it is.
Oh, that one.
I know which one it is. One. Okay. All right. Why that? Right. I'm not embargoed. I didn't say anything. I'm just guessing. Should we move on to Birth of a Nation?
God, let's, yes.
Let's do that. Two stars for Office Christmas Party.
I thought it was when it came out in 1924.
This is The Birth of a Nation. Oh. It's a little bit different, a lot different from D.W. Griffith's clan-heavy version of American history. This is Nate Parker's take on the Nat Turner slave revolt of 1831. So it's set in Virginia. Nat Turner, who's also played by Nate Parker, is a plantation preacher, and he comes gradually to feel like armed rebellion is the only possible way forward for those living in bondage. And so he and his fellow slaves rise up against their tyrannical masters with predictably violent consequences on both sides. It takes a long time to get there, though. This is not a hugely long film. It's 2 hours, and I think, some versions of this would have been 3 hours. But it does take, the slave uprising is the end and not the beginning, if you will, of the story. It's a very well-made film in a way that feels slightly old-fashioned. Now, there was talk of Parker talking to Mel Gibson before he made this and discussing Braveheart, and apparently they genuinely discussed how Mel made Braveheart, and it has a little bit of that feel to it. It feels like a biopic very much in the Braveheart vein.
All right.
And coming after, you know, a film like 12 Years a Slave, there's a huge difference in tone as a result. This feels much more... bombastic is the wrong word, but it's much more towards bombast.
Broader.
Broader, I think, is... Yeah, you're absolutely right.
It premiered at Sundance this year, didn't it?
Yeah.
It sold for a record price.
Yes.
And
that was less than he could have got because he wanted the right sort of, you know, launch for it and... Mm. And the right sort of support, because it was being talked up as an Oscar contender. Now, due to controversial events in Parker's own history, that mm-hmm. buzz seems to have died down a lot, because he is inextricably linked with this film. He is writer, director, producer, and star. You can't talk about this film without talking about him.
Yeah.
And I think that has hurt the film's Oscar chances. That is not to say that it is not worth seeing as a piece of cinema, but it is a really tough watch, because if 12 Years a Slave emphasised the sort of the psychological brutality of slavery. I mean, there was physical abuse in there, don't get me wrong, but what really was chilling about that was the removal of freedom and just the damage that does to your psyche. This one is very much more at the physical end of the spectrum, and the violence is extremely physical, and it honestly does recall The Passion of the Christ at times in terms of the sheer amount of brutality and whipping and beating and blood and all of that kind of violence. And that's useful and important in a way, because we shouldn't overlook that side of this inhumane system. But at the same time, I find it almost slightly less effective in some ways, because it I think it's less good at getting into the psychological side of it, and
right.
less good at showing the effects of a lack of freedom on your personality.
It is an important subject, and there should be a lot of different ways through
that's
it.
True, that's
it
true.
It doesn't have to, you know, there shouldn't be one monolithic way of looking at it.
No, that's absolutely true. I think given Parker's own experience, the film's treatment of its female characters, which isn't brilliant, is particularly unfortunate. But it is unquestionably powerful, and it will really shake you. And it's very, very tough to watch, which I think is the point, and I think is the purpose of it. And it does look at an overlooked piece of history, which deserves another look. So we give it 4 stars, which I think is fair.
If you see one film this week, you'd see that.
Yeah, absolutely. Out of these ones, definitely. It is flawed, but at the same time, it's extremely powerful.
So there you go then, 4 stars for The Birth of a Nation. And that is it for this week's Emperor Podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun, where we'll be joined by a double whammy. We'll have Forest Whitaker, one of the stars of Rogue One, A Star Wars Story.
Ooh.
That's very exciting. And Ricky Gervais talking about the DVD and Blu-ray release of David Brent, Life on the Road. And that is a cracking interview. We haven't done Forest Whitaker yet. I presume that Forest Whitaker will be equally cracking. But... Who knows?
We can talk up to him about Ghost Dog. It'll be brilliant.
It'll be awesome. And also keep an eye out for our Rogue One spoiler special as well, which is coming your way Monday 19th of December. So 3 days after the film comes out around the world. We'll be talking to Gareth Edwards, the director of that film. So very, very excited about that as well. Until next week, though, it is goodbye from Helen.
Toodaloo.
It's goodbye from Ian Freer.
Keiko Bako.
Cake.
That's amazing. And it's goodbye for me. I'm off to launch an unprovoked assault on the Winchester brothers. See how Helen likes it.
How dare you?
You came at Jack McCoy. You come at Jack McCoy, you better not miss.
I didn't.
That's all I'm going to say.
It's all true.
That's all I'm going to say.
He's a liberal.
What's wrong with that?
So many things. You're so unwoke right now.
I'm such a woke bae. See you next week.